and may it please the court. The URA provides for prevailing plaintiffs in inverse condemnation cases under the Tucker Act for a fee shifting statute that provides that the court shall award to the plaintiff as part of the judgment reasonable attorney's fees and costs. This provision is mandatory and is a known risk by the government that the government undertakes when, instead of condemning, they force their citizens into an inverse condemnation action. In addition, the fee shifting provision does not apply to condemnation actions, so the risk of paying the attorney's fees is one that can be completely avoided by the government.
Do you agree that the same standards ought to apply in this statute as under 1988, for example?
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that the standards for calculating a reasonable fee should be the same across all of the statutes that use the phrase reasonable fee. I think it's important to realize, however, that if one departs from the objective criteria of the Lodestar, which the Supreme Court continually affirms should happen only in rare instances, but if you're to depart from that Lodestar calculation and look at subjective factors, pull them back out of the Johnson case from 1973 in the Fifth Circuit and look at things like the results obtained or the significance of the action, then you need to go back to what was the core statute.
Well, is results obtained relevant?
I do not think it is relevant, Your Honor.
Doesn't Riverside say that even in rejecting proportionality tests, that results obtained still relevant?
You know, Your Honor, if you look, yes, first of all, the answer to the question is it says that. But when you look at the body of Supreme Court cases that starts with Hensley and now ends with Perdue, Hensley approaches it at something of a 50-50 level. You start with Lodestar, and then you start applying Johnson. And then you go to Blanchard and Bloom and the city of Riverside, and then you get to Perdue. And in each of those cases in progression, the court gives a nod to, well, maybe you could depart from Lodestar, and maybe the Johnson factors still have some relevance, but not in this case. And by the time you get to Perdue, where it says that these departures must be rare and in exceptional circumstances, I think the question of whether one can apply the Johnson factors, particularly the ones subsumed in the Lodestar calculation, which includes results obtained, the factor relied on by the district court, by the time you get to Perdue, when you are looking at whether or not any room still exists to apply the Johnson factors, it has become almost an esoteric question. I don't know.
So results obtained isn't a relevant factor anymore in your view?
In my view, Your Honor, I don't think it's relevant, and I don't think the court needs to get to the question of whether there is still a tiny crack where an exceptional case can call for the application of that factor after the fact as opposed to in the Lodestar itself, because this case is not an exceptional case. It's not a rare case. This is a complex taking case which was well litigated below, where both parties presented a straight Lodestar analysis to the district court. That's what the plaintiff did. They exercised billing judgment. They cut 317 hours before the claim ever went in. They asked for no interest. They used historic rates. They billed in tenth of an hour increments. Yes?
The statute says such sum as will, in the opinion of the judge,
reimburse. That's right.
In the opinion of the judge. That seems to endow Judge Davis in this case with a vast amount of discretion, does it not?
Well, it might bestow a vast amount of discretion if it were not for the progression of Supreme Court decisions that have increasingly narrowed that discretion and moved more and more and more to a straight Lodestar analysis. for the particular reason as stated in Purdue, that the court wants to cabin the discretion. The court wants predictable results, they want objective results, and they do not want to have results colored by subjective considerations of a particular district court.
It's also clear that the factors that go into the lodestar, they cannot be taken into account. Is a negative enhancement to be treated, call it that? None of the cases deal directly that I've seen yet with a negative enhancement in terms of the Supreme Court cases. Did I miss one in there?
You know, you may
they
have.
They all go the other way.
Most go the other way. I suggest Blanchard as a case where a contingency agreement was being applied below to cap a fee, and it went up to the Supreme Court, who said the contingency fee agreement has no part in this analysis. You have to go back to Lodestar.
What about the contingency fee in this case? The trial judge seemed to think that was relevant to setting the amount.
Yes, he did. And I think that his view of that relevance absolutely drove the 50% reduction in this fee so that
what's
it would
wrong
fit.
With that? Isn't that a within his discretion?
No, it's not within his discretion.
It
was not a relevant factor as it was applied by this court.
No, but
in this
general,
case,
the Supreme Court has said you can't cap the fees based on the contingent fee agreement, but it is a relevant factor, right?
That is, in fact, what the court said when the Federal Claims Court in the Sheldon case and the Court of the Claims Court in the Branning case looked at those issues within the context of the URA. They read any leftover discretion, they did not think they had any leftover discretion to apply.
No, but the Supreme Court has said that the fee arrangement is still a relevant factor, right? Though it can't be governed.
In one of the cases before Purdue, the court said it was still a relevant factor, a possibly relevant factor.
Well, don't we have to follow that? We're not supposed to ignore what the Supreme Court tells us to do.
Well, I think.
Tell they explicitly change.
Well, I believe if one is going to follow what the Supreme Court does in the contingency cases, then one does not stop at the possible relevant factor language that they put in the opinion on the way to saying the contingency agreement in Blanchard should not be used to decrease the fees calculated under the lodestar. And they say that because...
I thought what Blanchard said was that it can't be used to cap the fees, but that it's a relevant factor, whatever that means.
Whatever that may mean. I'm sure Your Honor's quotation of the Blanchard decision is correct. I would also say that as the lower courts deal with how to apply that decision, certainly the Federal Claims Court has not thought it had the discretion to have the contingency fee be a major factor. And I would also point out that even if you were going to think that it is a factor, if you look at the retention agreement in this case, the retention agreement provides that the counsel will get the greater of the fees awarded under a lodestar basis or one-third of the recovery.
Ms. Kaufman, Judge Davis noted that the stipulation happened way back in 2003.
Yes.
And said that the negotiations which happened thereafter were not very difficult, suggesting as well a reason for reducing the fees. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. The timeline of this case is a little unusual. It was filed in 1999. Judge Hanna had it and was supervising it at that point. Judge Hanna was the judge for this case through the very complex
work. Why did it start in Kansas?
Why did it start in Kansas? Because at that time, it was thought that we could have a nationwide multi-trail class action, so that there were plaintiffs in the Swisher case in Kansas involving a trail in Kansas, involving this trail in Texas, involving a trail in Iowa, I think that's the Lowers case, and Indiana. The Swisher court said she wasn't going to deal with anything but Kansas and transferred out all of those sister cases to their home districts. And the Bywaters case went to Texas. Returning to your question, Judge Rader, 58% of the hours of this in this case were incurred at that early stage before Judge Davis ever had responsibility for the case. We then, the parties then agreed to cooperatively work to subcontract out all of the administrative work in this case. So they found a claims administrator to do the somewhat administrative work of identifying who were the landowners on the record date and taking care of notice. They subcontracted out to an appraiser to do the appraisal work, and then attorneys at the appropriate level supervised, jointly supervised, those contractors responsible for the administrative work. The counsel on this case worked very well together. They have worked together on multiple Trails Acts. They know what they can argue for. They know what they're going to win or not. They want to do them efficiently. And the parties jointly operated and cooperated in such a way that they didn't have to bring a dispute to Judge Davis. It's not because the issues did not require a high level of expertise. They just didn't require the district judge because these counsel were doing what they were supposed to be doing.
But the timeline is to the point that Chief Judge Rader was pointing to.
Yes.
The same question I had. The trial judge notes that the class action was certified in 2000. The stipulation of liability was agreed to in 2003. And then it took 6 years to settle the damages claim. And the question is, why did it take 6 years to settle damages? I appreciate that you had to figure out what deeds were fee simples and what deeds were easements for the railroad, and you had to keep track of how many were in your Texas claim.
I believe there were 400 pluses, Your
Honor. 400?
400 pluses.
So the puzzle is why it took 6 years. Who caused the trial judge's point was that this and some of the Supreme Court dicta suggests that lawyers will drag this sort of thing out in order to build their fees. Do we have such a problem here?
No, you do not. Only 20% of the fees were incurred during that period of time when the parties were jointly supervising. We can absolutely agree that took too long. The sister cases that we have spoken about settled out in 2005. The same counsel were doing the same things in the cases.
When you keep referring to the counsel getting along, you're talking about government counsel.
Government counsel and plaintiff's counsel.
Or
yes.
Just the two plaintiff's counsel.
The two sides. There is, in fact, for most of this time, only one plaintiff's counsel who billed almost all of the hours on this case after that stipulation in 2003. It was only 20% of the time. The hours were 30 or 40 hours a year in 2005, 2006, 2007. The years Judge Davis is worried that we were dragging it out. And I think it's important to note that the government, who has every incentive to try and does take issue with any hour they can take issue with, when we put in a fee claim, specifically said the majority of our hours were reasonable. The lodestar was the presumptive basis for doing the calculation, and they had no objection to a single hour in 1999, 2006, and 2005, 6, and 7.
What about the government's argument that you should have applied, the district court should have applied the forum rate here, that both under regional circuit law and under our law, presumption is the forum?
Well, I think there are two parts. parts to that question, Your Honor. One is the choice of law question. Is it the forum law, or is it the law of the Fifth Circuit?
Well, it's treated under both the Fifth Circuit law and under our own law, it's reflected in the Bureau. The presumption is the forum, and you only depart from it in unusual circumstances. So why shouldn't the forum rate, that is the Texas rate, the District of Texas rate, apply here?
Your Honor, the government cites the Avera case. We're obviously familiar with the Avera case. It was, as you know, because you wrote the decision, written in the context of an immunization program where the...
Yeah, I understand, but the question is, Avera says the forum rate, regional circuit law says the forum rate. Why depart from the forum rate here? What's the justification for not using the forum rate?
Okay. If I may reserve our contention that Avera is limited to the circumstances in the statute in that case and point the court to the fact that every federal claims court and court of appeals who have looked at the decision have looked at it and
but that's
included...
not the question. The question, Avera says the presumption is the forum. Avera departed in unusual circumstances from the forum. Forum rate is the usual rule. Why shouldn't the forum rate apply here?
Okay. These are the reasons the forum rate should not apply. If the court would be otherwise inclined to take the holding of Avera and apply it to URA cases. URA cases, and particularly the Tucker Act cases and the Trails cases, are highly complex. They call for very specialized skills. You have an declaration of the record from the plaintiff saying he investigated counsel in his hometown and could find them. None. That was the same situation in Swisher, where the court dealt with this issue of whether Federal Circuit or Tenth Circuit would control, and that's when she thought Federal Circuit would mean that the hometown rule applied, and concluded that the result would be the same under the Tenth Circuit that does the forum rule, or the Federal Circuit that she presumed did the hometown rule, because in each case there was because in the Tenth Circuit there was an exception when you had to go out of the jurisdiction.
Kaufman, your life's been read for some time.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Out of the jurisdiction to get competent counsel, I would suggest this is one of those circumstances.
Thank you, Ms. Kaufman. We'll restore your rebuttal time. Could you give an extra 2 minutes to Ms. Durkee if she needs to use it?
Okay, please, the court. I'm Ellen Durkee for the United States, and hopefully I don't need the extra time. On either of two alternative grounds, this court may affirm the judgment of $413,000 for attorney's fees, and this takings case required very little litigation that was brought in the Eastern District of Texas. Now, I will turn to those issues in turn, but there were a couple of things that I wanted to make sure that I address based on the discussion so far. And first of all, I would like to point out that Blanchard, the holding of Blanchard was that contingency fee cannot be determinative, it cannot be the absolute cap, as the Court of Appeals had held there. But it does say that it is a relevant consideration.
But in this case, Ms. Durkee, the contingent fee was not a contingent fee as such. The contingent fee was calculated either on the value of our professional services at our regular hourly rate or by multiplying by one-third, et cetera, the contingent fee, whichever is greater. So it seems to me that the actual document that they signed, the bank signed, clients, precludes using the contingent fee as a cap or even as a major consideration. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, it certainly it's not a cap. And I believe it's the fee agreement is a consideration in both aspects for these reasons. First, part of the point I want to make is that this is a class action. It is controlled not only by the URA, but by Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And then the advisory notes to Rule 23H that talks about reasonable attorney's fees it talks about, it says, active judicial involvement measuring fee awards is singularly important to the proper operation of class action process. In a class action, the district court must ensure that the amount and mode of payment are fair and proper, whether the fees come from a common fund or otherwise paid. Even in the absence of objections, the court bears this responsibility. And then it drops down and says, courts have given way to agreements among the parties regarding the fee motion. Side agreements regarding fees provide at least perspective pertinent to an appropriate fee award. So I think we accept that it is a pertinent consideration. And the reason I think that it supports what the district court did in figuring in this case is this. The court said, I'm trying to figure out what the attorneys contemplated as a fair award here. We know it can be a third of the overall award, one third. Or it said it's regular hourly rate.
Whichever is greater.
But you see, what we have objected to all the way through here is the hourly rates. There is no evidence this is their regularly hourly rates.
Here's my problem with your case. Let me be very succinct with you. The trial judge says reasonable hours are X number, and he wipes out the part for the amicus, whatever that number is. Reasonable hours are so many. And he says, let's look at the fees. He looks at the fees. Goes through the whole calculation. Reasonable fees. He multiplies those two numbers together, which is exactly what he's obligated to do under the lodestar analysis. At that point, he suddenly says, oops, I'll reduce it by 50%. Now, first of all, having found that the hours were reasonable and the fees were reasonable, there's a real question as to whether he can make a downward adjustment on the basis of no basis. But the bigger question for me at the moment is, where did he get 50%? Why not 35? 52? 78? He makes no explanation whatever of where the 50 came from, other than the number happens to work out to be close to what a contingent fee is. And if that's so, then it seems to me he clearly abused his discretion by applying implicitly, if not explicitly, a contingent fee which he couldn't even apply because it says whichever is greater. Help me get over that hurdle. That's my big problem with your case. First, he finds the fees a reasonable, lodestar amount, the hours are reasonable, and then suddenly he picks it up. What do we do with that?
I want to say the 2 points and then I'll enlighten you. First of all, in pro rata reductions, which are very common, this is the kind of percentage things that courts don't explicitly, they do it on top of the lodestar, this is very common. Secondly, the government has provided and has argued all the way through a mathematical way to get to this particular judgment. And that's why I think the form rule is particularly important, because that's how you get there. The form rule gives you this number. Now, going back to your question about how did the judge come up with it, obviously, I can't show you in his decision where he said, for this part, we're going to take, you know, this percentage and so on. But he did have more than one reason for reducing it.
But it tends to look a bit as though he's applying proportionality. And looking at the fee agreement, the alternative percentage is being highly pertinent. Isn't this a case in which he's gone too far in considering the results? Even if he can continue to consider the results, isn't this a case in which it looks as though he's applied a rule of proportionality?
I disagree with that reading of the court's decision. I don't think, you know, it reads to say, I have to have it be proportional. This is a cap on what you can get. What he is saying is that I am looking at the overall results, and this is an appropriate consideration under Supreme Court law, under especially in class action lawsuits. And he's saying, and this is where, you know, I think an important part of this is he was explaining this was not a difficult case. Most of the tasks were administrative. It was, especially after the United States conceded the liability, and yet the fee amounts were based on very, very high hourly rates. And there is, you know, and that it provides a basis for reducing.
Excuse me. Explicitly to be reasonable. Now, had he said the rates were unreasonably high for the reasons you're citing to us, that might have presented a wholly different case. But he didn't. The trial judge specifically made a finding that the rates were reasonable. I don't see how we can find that finding an abuse of discretion.
I think that you can find, I think what you can find is that he exercised his discretion by taking into account the ease of the work, if I may, at the second stage in the analysis. And that really is, to me, the question. Is he required to only do that in calculating the lodestar? Hensley would suggest that you do not have to do that. A lot of case law would suggest that courts are not confined to doing it at that first step, that they can take into account when they're applying the Johnson factors. Did that lodestar take into account all the relevant factors? In this case, he said it didn't, because you're looking at very high, by the way, DC rates, not the laughing matrix rates, but another matrix that come up to bump them up even
what
more.
What proportion of these high rates, as you described, are built into this calculation? The petitioner suggests she said 20% or something like that occurred after the liability determination.
I don't remember the exact figures in my brief, but I believe that almost half, closer to half of the of the fees, the amount was after the liability stipulation. And so the more the pattern is that you had associates working on the case prior to that time, and then after the stipulation liability is much more of a trend for the higher price attorneys to be working on it. And that had it. So you can look at it in terms of hours, but you can also look at it in terms of amounts and hourly rates, and that's where we're concerned that it gets skewed.
Well, what about the forum rate issue? Both under our law and the Regional Circuit law, there's a presumption in favor of using the forum rate. Plaintiff argues here that the forum rate was not appropriate because there wasn't competent counsel available in Eastern District of Texas. What's the answer?
Well, the answer to that is that in the district court, they basically were so sure that the forum rule did not apply that they really didn't put any evidence in. The only evidence that they put in was a very general affidavit by Mr. Bywaters that said, I had a local attorney, but unnamed, but it appeared to me that he wasn't really able to help me, and I looked and I found these people. The case law...
He does not say that he couldn't find competent counsel in Texas.
He said he... Where's
the affidavit?
It's in the joint appendix at page 539. He said, I had an attorney that was local in the region to help me. Despite this attorney being known to me, being very experienced, came evident early on this attorney was unable to help me and others with what he described to be a complex specialty area of law. I therefore began a lengthy search to find an attorney who was knowledgeable. After researching property groups, the only attorney I could find in the whole country would help me is the Ackerson Group. Now, the reason I don't think this is sufficient, first of all, you've got case law in the courts of appeals, like the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, that says you can't just be a self-serving affidavit by party of litigation. There has to be, that typically you need affidavits from Texas attorneys that would say. Secondly, what we showed
the affidavits from the attorneys say, the Texas attorneys say, yes, I agree, I'm incompetent, good in this case.
Ap- apparently they find them because they're in, usually in the case, it's a, and I'm sure they're worded in it to us. So.
They probably put it more delicately.
More delicately. The other thing is that we showed you, right, the expertise of, I think you also have to look at, first of all, the action group is not the only attorneys that handle this case. The Coons group also handled it. And in their declaration, which is in the joint appendix at page 530, what they said was, we have gotten interested in this because we're part of a consortium of firms that have been doing the fiber optic cable cases. And and this was sort of a natural move in this area of law. Well, what we pointed out is there were class actions handled by attorneys in the Eastern District of Texas, from Beaumont and so on, that did fiber optic cable litigation. So that would suggest that that's what their qualifications are, that these people handle it. And secondly, you know, I don't know what to make of this because we don't have all the information, but what we do know is that their complaint was filed, was signed by a Texas attorney who was part of this consortium. They did not seek fees on the forum, but that would suggest to me that it was more just how they decided they wanted to staff this case, not because they couldn't find Texas attorney.
Why does this give me an uneasy feeling that the government now wants to participate in the selection of plaintiffs' counsel?
I don't think... That's not it at all. What the government, our concern is this. The taxpayers pay these fees. And
that's the choice Congress has made.
And reasonable fees has been, the Supreme Court has said, and the other courts have said, that it is not the highest rates in the richest law firms of the country. The reason that the forum rule is developed is that it has an ease of administration and has an aspect of fairness. And what from our perspective, the argument is, you know, they can choose their attorneys, absolutely. But the question is, when they choose to go to the Eastern District of Texas, and I want to talk to you about why they did that, should they be paid at the forum rate, or should they be able to get raised at one of the highest, you know, legal rates in the country? The reason, you know, the government asked to transfer this case and the district court denied it. And in their response in opposition to transferring to this court, what they said was, well, you know, it's true, but they had two arguments. One is it's convenient for the parties to have it in Texas. But the other, and I suspect more important reason, is they said, you know, the Rule 23 for class actions, we're going to be at a disadvantage because of the way the Court of Federal Claims applies Rule 23. It is to our benefit to be in the Eastern District of Texas because they allow opt-out class actions, and the Court of Federal Claims only allows them to opt in. So they chose that in order for them to get a higher rate of compensation for the attorneys, so that the whole class, you know, amount would become larger. And yet when it is now to their detriment to look at things like the forum, they're saying, no, the forum has nothing to do with it. We can choose to be wherever we want. We can choose to get, you know, as if we fought it.
Quick question for you. Do you have any comment you want to make about the table that's included in the reply brief that sets out all the various cases in which the damages were substantially smaller than the fees the court awarded?
Yes, I have no, I assume those numbers are correct. We have not made the argument that you cannot get fees that exceed the rate. Now, the difference in those cases, though, that you can't just see from the numbers is we don't know, you know, you can't see what the hourly rate they requested are. I can tell you this, in Swisher, a case that they rely on, the hourly rates, their regular hourly rates that they build on were approximately $80 to $100 an hour less for the exact same attorneys than they're asking for here. And those figures also don't tell you how much litigation led to that. So I do want to be perfectly clear, we're not denying that sometimes in the rate, the return rate, to comply with the amount. The court has that for the question.
Ms. Galvin, we restored your 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
I very much appreciate it. Complex issues in the litigation, complex issues in the appeal. Forgive me for speaking. With respect to whether or not it was a violation of law for the district court to cut these fees by 50% on the basis of the results of change, the Delaware Valley decision from the Supreme Court in 1986 says, we specifically held in Bloom that the novelty and complexity of the issues, special skill and experience of counsel, quality of representation, results obtained from the litigation are presumably fully reflected in the lodestar amount and thus cannot serve as an independent basis for increasing the fee or deviating from the lodestar. In this case, the court calculated the lodestar, found that it was reasonable, found that the rates were reasonable, found that the hours were reasonable, and then he cut 50% because he was trying to push this case into a private court case paradigm that the retention agreement certainly does not support and which completely undermines the whole purpose of Congress in fee shifting statutes. The purpose of Congress in fee shifting statutes is to change the question on initiation of the suit from can I afford it to can I win? And if I can I find a counsel who will wait 12 years to get paid for it?
The government suggests you stay out of the Court of Federal Claims in order to boost your fees.
Well,
do you have a comment about why did you choose the little tucker which limited your fee, your recovery in each case to less than $10,000 in each instance?
The $10,000 cap was sufficient to get full recovery for this class. The court found in the settlement approval that the full value of the parcels was obtained. It is absolutely the case that the appraiser was going to have to come from Texas, and it makes
sense.
There
was no parcel valued at more than $10,000 anywhere?
I do not believe so. There were a few. But most of them were $10,000, and the opt-out procedure permits people to opt out in that circumstance. I would also point out that the court permits us in the Little Tucker Act to go locally. And I wasn't there. I don't know what the calculation was in terms of fees. I do know absolutely that the calculation in terms of the quality of relief given in an opt-out class versus an opt-in class is extreme, and it is much better with class to have an opt-out class than an opt-in class.
Red light.
I am so sorry.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, sir.